Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, have you been hearing about critical race theory a lot lately? Guess what? It's actually been around for decades. It's a broad set of ideas about systemic bias and privilege in America. But in the wake of widespread protests over criminal justice and race in this country, critical race theory, or CRT, is fast becoming one of the more explosive flashpoints in the nation's culture war, including here in Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis is pushing for a reworked civics education curriculum for K through 12 students in Florida. Now, here's the governor in March when he announced his plan to use more than $100 million in federal COVID stimulus funding for civics education.
Let me be clear. There's no room in our classrooms for things like critical race theory. Teaching kids to hate their country and to hate each other is not worth one red cent of taxpayer money.
Now, the Florida Board of Education meets next month in Jacksonville, where it's expected to adopt new rules for teaching history and civics to Florida students. Last month, Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran discussed his opposition to critical race theory in a speech at the conservative Hillsdale College in Michigan. He claimed textbook publishers conceal the material.
They hide it in what's, you know, social emotional learning. So it doesn't say critical race theory, but you could definitely have a teacher who teaches critical race theory.
Now, educators warn that these changes could make teachers cautious in what and how they teach, confining lessons to limited views of American history and current events. So that's where we're going to begin this program here live on this Friday. What is critical race theory? Who should decide what history should be taught in Florida classrooms and how it should be taught? Phone lines are open now, 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. You can also share your thoughts on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
Emily Block joins us now. She covers education for the Florida Times Union. Emily, always good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's begin by explaining what is critical race theory. This is an academic theory that's been around for decades, and doesn't it have to do with the way race and racism affects our policies in America, our government and criminal justice policies?
Yes, exactly, Melissa. It's a movement that examines the intersections of race, law, and equity, and how that impacts, you know, whether you're in the classroom or on the street. It's a nuanced theory. And the funny part about it is that it's not technically written into any curriculum in Florida schools right now.
That's right. It's not currently being taught, although we're seeing a push in legislatures around the country to ban the teaching of critical race theory. We heard the governor just there say it teaches kids to hate themselves and hate each other. Critics of his remarks say that's a fundamental misreading of what this is all about. What are your thoughts?
Right. At the end of the day, there's no way around it. This is a super political conversation, right? And that's what teachers tell me that they're worried about. They're worried that this is another example of politics seeping into the classroom and potentially guarding important conversations that they want to have in the classroom. An education program director that I spoke with, David Hoppe from the University of North Florida, told me that he doesn't really know how teachers could, you know, address things that are going on in a, whether it's a civics class or just a regular, you know, social studies class or English class, without somehow, you know, tapping into a little bit of critical race theory. He says that he doesn't know if teachers can ignore what's going on in society, whether it's protests on the street, killing, systemic racism and equity. Those are conversations that just kind of naturally occur.
You've covered this in Jacksonville, the push in Jacksonville to rename schools named after Confederate soldiers, and a teacher who's been reassigned for displaying a Black Lives Matter flag in her classroom. So from the perspective of teachers, is there a sense that they're being silenced or muzzled in what they can teach the kids about American history and about the history of race in this country?
That's definitely a concern that I've been hearing from teachers, especially based on directly what, you know, Commissioner Corcoran's comments were. He said something along the lines of having to police teachers every day, you know? And so critical race theory opponents are saying that this is that this theory is a pipeline to public school wokeness. And teachers are saying that's not the case at all. So it's absolutely something that I'm hearing from teachers, that they're concerned about Richard Corcoran's comments, that they're concerned about being policed in schools. And especially that when, you know, when he made those comments on Hillsdale, he did directly refer to Amy Donofrio, the Duval County Public Schools teacher, who says she was removed from the classroom for hanging a Black Lives Matter flag in her classroom. And he was talking about race theory and textbooks. So it's not even fully clear how that conversation, you know, went from critical race theory to and textbooks to a Black Lives Matter flag in Duval County.
Now, this is all leading up to a school board, or excuse me, a Department of Education, Board of Education meeting in Jacksonville in June, where the educational board is expected to adopt new rules or standards around the teaching of not only history, but also civics in Florida. Can you tell us what we might expect out of that meeting, Emily?
Sure. So that meeting is taking place on June 10th. And it seeks to impose new guidelines based on what we're talking about. It says that teachers facilitating discussions, it has to be age appropriate, that they can't share their personal views or attempt to, and these are direct quotes, indoctrinate or persuade students to a particular point of view that's inconsistent with state standards. We're actually seeing a lot of the language that's being used is kind of mirroring an executive order that former President Trump used on, you know, on systemic racism and the teachings and ideologies behind that. So we're seeing a lot of mirrored language. And of course, teachers are concerned that this is overreaching and representative of things that are a sign of things to come. They're worried that this means that they can't talk about systemic racism and how it affects their own students.
From the proposed rule, one of the instructions is that teachers may not, quote, suppress or distort significant historical events such as the Holocaust, may not define American history as something other than the creation of a new nation based largely on universal principles stated in the Declaration of Independence. That's just part of that new policy that the department, the Board of Education, State Board of Education, is going to be considering in Jacksonville next month. 305-995-1800. Emily Block continues with us, talking about critical race theory, the teaching of history and race in Florida classrooms. Let's begin in with Ken in Clearwater. Ken, thanks for calling in and holding on. You're on the radio.
Yes, sir. I'm really glad that I got my opportunity to express my concerns. I'm very concerned that Governor DeSantis has decided or is in the process of deciding not to include CRT as a valid part of the curriculum. I think it cheats the students from learning about reality, about the world from which we are all existing in. As a teacher for, I guess, 25 years, I've had opportunity to be exposed to students from all over the world. I taught at Eckerd College in one of their English programs for international students. And I had the wonderful opportunity of meeting people from Japan and China and Russia and Germany and just South America, every country. And it was so interesting to see how these students understood and accepted each other, because they had a sense of historical background. Mm-hmm. They knew where they came from. And if DeSantis continues on this very short-sighted path, he'll cheat our students from understanding where we are in this world. Now, just as Trump doesn't want to get the January 6th commission put together, along with Mr. Mitch McConnell, it's the same idea. They do not want us to be exposed to the truth. The truth is, all of these groups from around the world have faced discrimination. The Chinese, the Japanese, yeah, in the Second World War, Tulsa, Oklahoma, the massacre of the blacks. Mm-hmm. Now, if we don't allow our students to understand this, You see, the scientist wants to say, oh, the students are going to hate each other.
Ken, we hear your point. We appreciate it. We've got a number of teachers calling in as well, in addition to yourself, Ken. Important perspective there, Ken from Clearwater. Chris in Orlando is also a teacher. Chris, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I've been teaching for going to be 8 years now. Went to school for basically the subject. And I got to tell you, we censored history in the past. It's called McCarthyism. It's ironically in the curriculum. And it didn't work out well. If somebody comes to me and says that I can't teach something that I know is historically true, I'm leaving. And so are most of the people I know that teach this subject.
So how are you going to approach this next school year, Chris, as a history teacher, if the board of the State Board of Education approves this rule?
It's against the contract. I can teach the way that I know is correct.
Okay. Emily, are there penalties attached to this policy proposal if teachers like Chris ignore it or somehow are accused of violating it?
Well, you know, a big concern that we're hearing is that it could be tied to funding potentially. So teachers and their principals and, you know, supervisors and even superintendents have expressed concern that, you know, if this curriculum is strong-armed in a way that someone doesn't necessarily agree with, it might potentially affect how that school district is funded, how that school is funded, especially in a time of, you know, COVID and recovering from that and seeing, you know, surplus coming from that. It just, you know, it ties back to everything. So yes, we are hearing a lot of concerns regarding funding and penalties and how that curriculum might be strong-armed down the line.
Rebecca tweets the Florida Roundup and says, I'd like all these opponents of critical race theory to explain what they think it is. When I was in school many years ago, history was all about glorifying explorers and conquerors, hardly a word about the conquered. I'm glad this perspective is changing. 305-995-1800 to share your thoughts about the teaching of critical race theory as Florida prepares to adopt new rules for the teaching of history and civics to public school kids. John is in Orlando. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
All right, thanks. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, it's a theory. I'm not up or down or sideways about it. I think it is something that should be offered to be taught along with a lot of other things. That's what school's there for. My concern is why can't we just go with the truth? And if you just documented, for instance, it's the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa massacre. Mm-hmm. That's not ever been. I'm 60. I was never taught that. It's a pretty interesting thing, along with a lot of other things. And so, like you say, if we just teach what has happened in history, I think a lot of the kids are smart enough to form their own opinions and create their own theories, you know, about what influences and what's good, bad, or indifferent related to our culture that we have today.
Thanks, John. You know, it's interesting he brings that up, Emily, the massacre in Tulsa of what was known as Black Wall Street 100 years ago, a thriving black community. White folks in surrounding neighborhoods and towns burned Black Wall Street to the ground. They killed a bunch of civilians. Here in Florida, there was a massacre at a little town called Rosewood at about the same time. And by and large, we weren't taught about these horrible incidents in history in school. So critical race theory would theoretically write, teach children about systemic racism through the lens of history and provide analysis around it. The teacher could analyze for the kids examples from the present and the past to show that we still have a problem with institutional racism. It's embedded in our laws and practices. That's really where the controversy lies, isn't it? That teachers could examine history through the lens of race.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the issue that we're seeing drilled down on, is that this does go into systemic racism. But of course, you know, supporters of this theory say that drills down into everything students are learning, whether it's the war on drugs or voter suppression, incarceration rates, redlining. And we even see it at a hyperlocal level, like in Jacksonville, when students, when Black students in particular, were complaining to the school district that they were finding out about local Black history through museums and through family members instead of in the classroom. They want to hear more of it from teachers and from, you know, a critical source and in a critical context. And another part of that viewer comment that really stood out to me was that students can make their own opinions. And that's what teachers continuously tell me, is that the whole point of being in a classroom and having a critical conversation is that people should be able to exchange different personal opinions and their backgrounds. And maybe not everyone agrees, but students, their teachers tell me that they're training their students to be able to take those ideas with logic and perspective, and it's not going to indoctrinate them.
Let's go to Rennell on line 8. Rennell, thanks for calling. You're on the radio now.
Hi, guys, and thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I'm a 57-year-old Black man in the state of Florida. One thing that I have noticed in my time, and my time alone, in my lifetime, is that we hide a lot of the bad. That benefits some, but it harms society as a whole. And it always seems that those that speak out against things that can heal this nation are the ones that cause problems. Critical race theory, number one, in my opinion, should not even be called critical race theory. It should just simply be called the truth of America's history. It is what it is. How are we ever going to be or become better people if we don't realize what we did wrong and how to fix it?
Rennell, I appreciate that perspective. Important to hear from you, and thanks for calling here to share that. 305-995-1800, talking about critical race theory, the teaching of history, what gets taught in Florida schools, how it gets taught. Emily Block, education reporter with the Florida Times Union. Emily, is there an enforcement mechanism with what the Board of Education is considering? We spoke about, you know, the potential penalties, but how could something like this be enforced?
It's really hard to say. And that's part of how complicated this is, right? We don't really know how this would be enforced. And that goes back to Richard Commissioner Corcoran's comments on having to police teachers every day. And that's what teachers tell me that they're concerned about, that they feel like they're getting shackled, essentially. Mm-hmm. The Commissioner of Education says that he has to police them every day to make sure that this isn't trickling into their lesson plans. You know, his comments also went into the book publishers, and he said something along the lines of that the books are never called critical race theory, that the messages are, you know, snuck in, is essentially what he was alleging. And so it's hard to say how this will be, you know, watched, policed, emphasized. It's really tricky, but I know that teachers are concerned. I mean, even, you know, Amy Donofrio, who has been in local news, said after these comments, said that she feared that her teacher license would be stripped.
And lots more tweets coming in. Here's one. I didn't know about the massacre in Tulsa or Ocoee or Rosewood. I feel cheated. Florida schools failed me. I didn't find out about Juneteenth till I was 45. Tweet us about critical race theory. We'll continue the conversation here on the Florida Roundup in just a moment. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And in Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. This week, the Palm Beach County Public School Board backed away from an equity statement it approved earlier this month. Now, the original version included a commitment to, quote, dismantling structures rooted in white advantage, end quote. That's the phrase the board voted to remove this week after 4 hours of public testimony. We're talking about race, education in the classroom. Emily Block still with us, covering education for Florida Times Union in Jacksonville. Emily, how have local school boards changed or not changed how they address racism in curriculum?
You know, it really depends on the school district, but what we've been seeing is that teachers are hearing their students and saying that they want to, you know, have these important conversations about what's happening outside, what's happening on their streets. We've seen, I feel like there's been a big shift from, you know, from the time of George Floyd onward. And, you know, with the insurrection, I worked on an article after the insurrection on January 6th, talking to teachers across the state about how they talked about this, how they, you know, and how they incorporated those, what was happening on these students' TV screens into conversation. And if they don't, they say that it's an elephant in the room. So they say that it makes their classrooms tighter and it makes them, you know, have a moment where they can, you know, appreciate each other's identities, even if they don't agree with every viewpoint, but they say it's a necessary conversation. And the concern among teachers I've spoken with is that those necessary conversations will be taken away with the imposing of a rule like this.
It's interesting when you look at the great sweep of history, and as we talk about the teaching of history, whenever there are steps forward taken, there's a backlash. Any great social movement sees a backlash. Would you categorize this, what Florida educational leaders and politicians are doing, as a backlash to the protests of the Black Lives Matter movement and the broader push for racial justice in America?
I think we're absolutely seeing backlash. You know, I think there's absolutely a loud student and teacher voice that want to have these critical conversations in the classroom. And they're saying that this is nothing new. There's just an extra spotlight.
And we're almost out of time, but I would encourage everyone to read your article about this in the Florida Times Union coming out later today, right?
Yes. So a lot of the professors and teachers that I've been referring to, that I've been talking to, a lot of that will be
check
in this
that
article
out.
That I have coming out later today.
Thank you, Emily Block at Jacksonville.com. Thanks so much. Well, Florida residents collecting unemployment will see less money in just 1 month as the state will drop out of the federal program that boosted weekly unemployment checks by $300. The payments could have continued through early September.
Yeah, it's just one of the topics we spoke with Federal Reserve Bank President Raphael Bostic from the Atlanta Federal Reserve.
I think that the labor market and businesses in Florida are on a really positive trajectory. If the places that have been hit the hardest are the places that have been coming back the strongest in the last several months. I think that bodes well for the Florida economy and for the U.S. economy more generally.
As you probably know, the state of Florida will stop participating in the additional federal unemployment benefits, which added $300 a week to state unemployment checks here in the Sunshine State. What could be the impact of that on the labor pool, on unemployment?
Where we are right now is in a very transitional state, where we've just come through a pandemic with a lot of distress and disruption. And now as we transition out, we need to really see where families are and where businesses are. So to my mind, the unemployment insurance has been an important component of a relief package to families to help them get to the other side without having as much damage as they might have otherwise. You certainly have some who are doing well, maybe earning more than they would have otherwise because the unemployment insurance benefits. But there are also others who are just choosing not to work because they still are unsettled in their house situation because kids have had to be home. There's a parent that's had to often be home with them. And that situation has not changed in the last several weeks. So there are going to be many who still have household situations to resolve. The same actually goes for senior care. So if you have an elderly parent or a relative, home health aides were not really in play. For many, that's still going to be the case. So there's stuff to be resolved there. You know, a lot of people have gone through a lot of stress. And I've talked to workers who have just said, I'm burned out. And I need to just take a breath and exhale for a bit. And then another thing that I think is really interesting is that, you know, as I've talked to some older workers and those closer to retirement, they've started to tell me that they're even thinking about their relationship to work in a different way. All of these things are happening pretty much at the same time. You know, this is one of the crazy things about a pandemic is that it does trigger deeper reflection, both by families and by businesses. We'll just have to wait and see. It's not so clear that there's any one reason why workers are coming back more slowly.
Florida has gained back about half of the jobs that it lost in March and April of 2020. Here we are 1 year later, and we've only regained 50% of those jobs back. A lot of folks still not in the labor force because of the reasons that you cited. What impact could that have on wages? Because workers will also point to wages as another reason, lower wages in Florida particularly, as a reason why the workers haven't reappeared since the pandemic has worn on.
I'm fairly optimistic about where jobs are going in the next several months. You know, at the beginning of this year, you know, if you looked at jobs at the lower end of the wage scale, they were about 15% below where they were pre-pandemic. In the last couple of months, they've cut, that number has been cut in half to where they're only like 6 or 7% below. To me, that's a very, very positive story. It suggests a trajectory consistent with the idea that we're going to get there eventually. The momentum is going in a positive way.
So the lower wage jobs are coming back faster.
Yes. The places that have been hit the hardest are the ones that are showing the most significant bounce and energy right now. And I think that's true at the in terms of the wage character, but also in terms of sector. If you look at hospitality and leisure over the last several months, there have been a lot of new jobs created in that those sectors. And as you guys know, I don't have to tell you this, that's a sector that's been hit extremely hard through the pandemic just because of the requirements for public health distancing and the like.
How are you seeing the direction of wages? Here in Florida, for instance, the minimum wage is due to go up to $10 an hour in September on its way to $15 an hour over the next several years. But we've seen wages both as a credit and a blame for not having more workers move into the labor force faster.
You know, I actually think wages will probably rise. It's not clear exactly how broadly that will be or how fast. But for most businesses that I've spoken with, the issue is margin and not just base costs. And so even though labor costs may be going up, there have been other things that they've been able to do to keep their margins in places that are comfortable. You know, one example is one of my contacts has told me that for restaurants and large chains that have a corporate office, you know, they've reduced their corporate office by 50% in some instances. That creates a lot of margin to be able to take on costs in other areas. So we may be able to see wages go up without that translating into more robust and powerful inflation.
One of the economic hotspots has been inflation. Inflation data has been picking up. We've seen higher car prices, higher used car prices, lumber prices, and those are now beginning to be factored into insurance premiums for auto insurance and replacement costs for home insurance, for instance. Is inflation under control?
So under control is a funny way to put it. To me, I would say...
Is it stable?
So that's another funny way to put it, in the sense that, you know, prices are changing all the time. And it's really, really what we're asking is, you know, is the band that we're seeing today likely to be the band that we see 3 months from now, 6 months from now, and 12 months from now? And right now, I think it's hard to make a strong case that the band that we're seeing today are going to be our new steady state, because we know that supply is coming back slower than demand. And when you have those kind of imbalances, that's going to be upward pressure in prices. Now, I was talking to someone a couple of weeks ago who was telling me that, you know, it's hard to get a rental car in Florida because, you know, the demand has just gone off the charts and they can't make cars because of the semiconductor issue. So there are lots of these sorts of pressures that are out there, and that's going to drive prices up. I guess the question we all have to ask ourselves is, to what extent are these supply disruptions going to persist? And, you know, many of these instances, I've heard stories to suggest that they're not really expecting them to be more permanent in character. And then the second piece is, if it persists for an extended period, and, you know, the extended period is still not a very precise term, if that happens, does the consumer change how they think about the market? Does the consumer fundamentally make a structural long-term decision based on what could be a short-term shock? And we actually can't know that answer right now.
Let me ask about one market that has seen significant price increases, the housing market, the Florida housing market, which is known for boom and bust cycles, certainly, but median price of single-family homes, condominiums in Florida are up double digits compared to a year ago. Every market is certainly different. Location matters, right? But overall, are you concerned about the sharp increase in housing prices?
Well, I'm not concerned the way I was in the Great Recession. Now, if you look at what's happening to house prices, we know that there is a shortage of homes that are being put up for sale that is as much lower than it has been historically. We know that families do have cash, so the savings rate in the U.S. is up. We know that financing costs, so interest rates on mortgages, are at historic lows. And we also know that it's hard to build new units because of the lumber shortages and the shortages in appliances and other things. So all of those would suggest that we have a dynamic where demand is going to be high and the available supply is going to be low. This isn't about excessive risk-taking or subprime lending or things like that, which would really generate a big concern. I think for me, the question is, you know, how do these supply side issues get resolved? Like, how long will it take for the lumber mills to be producing at quantities and volumes that caused the price to fall? It's three times higher now than it was just months ago. And then also, at what point do existing homeowners really start to feel like, okay, I kind of know where things are. I can actually contemplate selling my house again. I can contemplate moving on to that next step in housing. I think that's going to come. It may not come until maybe the fall.
You are a voting member of the committee of the Federal Reserve that sets the Fed's short-term target interest rate. It's been at zero since a year ago, April. It's expected to remain at zero for at least another year. The bank also has been buying $80 billion worth of government bonds each month, $40 billion worth of mortgage bonds each month. Has the Fed encouraged too much credit, too much borrowing?
So I don't think so. Let me provide some context on this. You know, we weren't in this policy stance 5 days before the pandemic.
That's true.
Right.
Right.
And so
right. So
the pandemic actually triggered this. And people should really keep in mind that, you know, our policy position is an emergency position. And, you know, the question that I ask myself every day is, are we still in that emergency?
How do you answer it?
I think so. We're 8 million jobs short of where we were. So there's still a lot of distress. There's been progress for sure. You've seen GDP rebounds to almost pre-pandemic levels. But our mandate is maximum employment and stable prices. And when I look at the employment side, there's still a ways to go. There's been progress, to be sure. And we're in a much better place than we were even 4 months ago. But I think there's still a ways to go. To that end, I think our policy stance right now makes sense and is appropriate. As we continue to make progress, as we get closer to that pre-pandemic level, or maybe even a little beyond that, then, you know, I think emergency stance is for emergencies. And when you're out of the emergency, we get out of the emergency stance. And that's really how I'm going to approach this. But right now, I think it's a hard case to make that to say that we're not still in crisis in too many communities.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We're speaking with Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta President Raphael Bostic. It's been about a year since the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis and the reckoning with race and equity that murder helped spark. You've led the Federal Reserve's efforts to address race in the economy. What are the immediate priorities 1 year on?
There are a couple things. So one, I think for me, a priority is to have everyone understand are the structures that we have in place and the way our economy works is not working for everyone. And we need to really be thoughtful in acknowledging that and then really step back and say, well, what are the barriers that are preventing that from happening? Because ultimately, for me, I think, and for my view of what our mandate is, like maximum employment is a better number when the economy is working for everybody. So we should be trying to do that. And for me, I really think that race and some of the ways that our economy has worked that to disadvantage minorities, particularly from an institutional or structural perspective, they've led our economy to be smaller than it would be otherwise, to be less resilient than it would be otherwise, and to be less innovative. And those are all things that I think the Federal Reserve has an interest in putting a spotlight on so we can get the full benefit and be better off. So for me, I think that's the highest priority. Then the second thing I would just say is, for me, I think it's important that everyone reflect on ways that they may be contributing or pushing back against some of these barriers that are preventing the economy from working for everyone. You know, the George Floyd episode, I think it really shook a lot of people and made people think hard about sort of how are things working I'll speak for myself, it's really caused me to think, what are the subtle things that we do at our bank in terms of our policies that may be putting stress on people that we just, that I just haven't given enough thought to. So those are the sorts of things that are, that I think are going to happen moving forward.
Within the financial community, particularly in the southeastern United States, what has the self-reflection been like over the past year as you've asked those financial leaders particularly to reflect upon policies, procedures, methods that they may not have thought in the context of race prior to a year ago?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I think that the answer varies pretty wildly across institutions. Now, I do think that for me, I've just been heartened that business leaders have that I've spoken to have really said, I've got a two-pronged issue. I've got to think about how I'm dealing with it internally with my staff and the distributions and who has voice. And, you know, am I relying on informal networks that might disadvantage people? And so where I'm not getting the most out of my team. And then externally, you know, what markets out there am I not necessarily reaching that could be markets for me to engage? And that would be both on the labor side, like hiring, but also in terms of, you know, marketing and advertising. So, you know, for financial institutions, this could be types of loan products. It could be types of savings accounts, all those sorts of things.
President Raphael Bostic, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. President Bostic, thanks for your time.
Tom, it's always good to be with you.
Still to come, new lawsuits filed against Florida's broadside against big tech. That's next here on the Florida Roundup.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Monday, Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law a bill prohibiting social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook from suspending politicians.
We now have a situation in which some of these massive, massive companies in Silicon Valley are exerting a power over our population that really has no precedent in American history.
Of course, Florida resident and former President Trump was kicked off Twitter, Facebook, after he incited the violent insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. Florida's new law, which promises stiff fines against tech companies that deplatform political candidates, is already being challenged in court by the tech industry.
Yeah, the groups call this new law a blatant attack on First Amendment rights of private businesses. They say the Florida law unlawfully forces tech companies to host content they might otherwise prohibit under their platform policies. Compelled speech. A spokesperson for the governor says the state has the authority to rein in a powerful entity that oversteps individuals' free speech rights. Well, let's hear you speak on this. 305-995-1800 is the phone number for your soapbox. 305-995-1800. And what the heck? Let's use big tech also to hear, right? Let's use Twitter. At Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle.
Why not? Well, for more on this, we welcome Clay Calvert, professor of law at University of Florida, director of the Marion B. Breckner First Amendment Project, and Matt Shears, president of the Computer and Communications Industry Association. Professor Calvert, we'll get to the constitutional questions with you in a moment. But first, Matt, let's begin with you, your organization, one of the entities suing. What is the nature of your complaint?
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me. So we're suing on behalf of the industry to try and safeguard the commitment that all of these digital services have made to us as their users to address harmful content online. And that can be anything from foreign disinformation and propaganda to anti-American extremism to fraud and predators and viruses and malware. These companies are in the trenches every day fighting against that bad content to ensure that it doesn't get in front of its users. And this bill would limit that flexibility and tie the hands of these companies as they're trying to meet these evolving threats in real time.
I see. Clay Calvert, in your legal opinion, does this new Florida law infringe on the First Amendment rights of these private, admittedly huge companies, but private companies?
Yes, I think it certainly does. And in particular, what we're talking about here is a First Amendment right not to speak or right not to be compelled to host content that an entity such as Twitter or Facebook does not want to hold. And the Supreme Court has recognized an unenumerated or implied First Amendment right not to be compelled to host content that the government, and that's what's happening here, it's the state of Florida telling these organizations and entities, you must host the content of candidates who violate your terms of use and terms of service, and you can't deplatform them. And so in other words, you have to host content with which you disagree and an individual who has failed to follow your terms of use and service. So that's where the First Amendment comes in here, a right not to speak.
And let me ask you as well, Matt, about the carve-out in this law for Disney. The law has an exemption for the websites of theme park operators. That's a big industry in Florida. Are you referencing that in your lawsuit?
The lawsuit does mention this, yes. And the backstory here is that the law is so sweeping in its definitions and application that it was only at the 11th hour that legislators realized that they were about to impose all these heavy-handed regulations on Disney. And instead of saying, perhaps we should go back to the drawing board, they simply said, okay, well, if you own a large theme park or entertainment complex of sufficient size, none of these regulations apply to you. And that, of course, makes no sense, because if the risk is that these, as they state, that these services are a threat to free expression, it shouldn't matter whether or not they own a theme park or a zoo.
Let's go to Adam calling from Miami. Adam, what are your thoughts about the new law?
I think this is a political stunt by a guy who's running again for governor and wants to be president. He wants to position himself as close to Donald Trump as he can, and he's going to waste tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayers' money defending a law that's clearly illegal and unconstitutional. The United States Constitution guarantees First Amendment rights by saying the government can't restrict them, not that individuals can't. And I think the excluding Disney from it just makes it more clear. I mean, look at what happened yesterday on Fox News. The only liberal commentator on the show, The Five, was just kicked off. They're allowed to do it. Nobody's complaining about that. It's just the political stunt wasting money from taxpayers.
Sorry to interrupt Adam and Melissa, but Juan Williams is what Adam is speaking about in terms of Fox News.
But his point being,
to stay,
you know,
in Washington D.C., he wasn't kicked off the program.
To his larger point, they made a business decision, a programming or editorial decision. Clay Calvert, these social media companies have resisted being defined as news providers. Yet that's what this is really all about, because these platforms are a source of news for many Americans. In the minute we have for the break, before the break, what about the caller's point that this is going to cost a lot in the courts and it might not survive a constitutional challenge?
Sure. And not only will it cost a lot to defend, but under federal statute, because this is really a civil rights violation act, we're talking about the First Amendment being violated. There's a statute that actually allows the prevailing party, and in this case, it might be the entities that sue the state of Florida, to recover reasonable attorney's fees and costs in doing so. We've seen this type of legislation in the past against the video games in the state of California, and that law was struck down, banning minors from accessing violent video games, and the video game industry was able to recoup all of its costs in litigation. So it's not only the state of Florida spending money to defend this law, but if it ultimately loses the state of Florida, it's going to have to pay the attorney's fees and costs of the prevailing parties against it.
Against it. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Matt Shears, president of the Computer and Communications Industry Association. Let me ask you this. There are those who think, well, this law is just a political stunt and it won't survive the constitutional test. But many Americans at the same time, of all political persuasions, think that the social media giants have become too powerful, that they should be broken up into smaller concerns. What are your thoughts about that?
Right now, you as consumers have a broad choice of digital services that they can go to for information, to socialize, to engage in commerce and gather information and interact with friends and family. You know, there is no one company that anyone needs to use. You can obtain your information just about everywhere. You know, depending on whether you look at this as the market of users going to the site, or you look at it from the market of advertisers who are looking places to advertise, there is a panoply of options available to everyone.
Facebook is by order of magnitude so much bigger a platform than, say, MeWe or some of the competitors that have sprung up.
That's certainly the case, but of course the First Amendment is freedom of speech. It's not freedom of reach. I mean, nobody's guaranteed or entitled to a particular audience. That's the marketplace of ideas. And so if a digital service says you're not welcome here, you can always go out on your own and set up your own website, use other tools to access users. But nobody is guaranteed to be able to reach all the users that they can reach on by using a particular platform.
We certainly saw former President Trump do that, Professor Calvert, with a website that he is now using to communicate with the world. Let's get one more call in quickly. It's Roger in Orlando. Go ahead, Roger.
Yes, hi there. I wanted to say that these tech companies, they have subscribers of all varieties of opinion. And when they squash any segment of their population, they are violating their responsibility to their subscribers. That's one. Number two, democracy is all about diversity of opinion and diversity of perspective. So if they are allowed to squash certain opinions and perspectives, now I personally am a liberal democratic, but I also am very rational, and I believe that we should do nothing at all to weaken American democracy by allowing large platforms to squash certain opinions.
All right. Thanks, Roger. In the minute we have left, Matt, what about that argument that taking someone, deplatforming them is squashing democracy?
So I understand where the caller is coming from. I think what's important to take away is those services have made commitments to their own users to try and protect them from particular types of problematic content. Different services are going to be different kinds of communities. And if one of them says, we don't want to host Nazi party candidates, that's a First Amendment decision that site can make. And that particular candidate isn't guaranteed to that platform. If people are unhappy with those kinds of decisions, they can find another community whose rules are more consistent with those decisions. That's what the marketplace of ideas is all about.
Professor Calvert, same question to you. Does it
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Matt's perspective. Yes, we need in a democratic society to be informed of all viewpoints, but it's not the responsibility of Twitter or Facebook to do that. Find another outlet, find another venue for doing that. I mean, the larger question here is, do we want to start treating these giant social media platforms more akin to broadcasters that can be regulated more closely? And currently, that's simply not the case. The Supreme Court would have to make a radical decision and say, no, we're going to now regulate these internet-based social media platforms much more closely, like free over-the-air broadcasting. And that's going to be a difficult road to hoe.
Yeah, that would be very different given the electromagnetic spectrum is thought to be public property. The government licensed for 7 years television and radio stations, whereas the internet is available to anybody, essentially, at this point. Clay Calvert with University of Florida, thank you for your time. And Matt Shears, president of the Computer and Communications Industry Association, thanks to you as well.
That's our show. Thanks, guys. The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jax, WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Padermo are the producers.
Our technical director is Peter Meritz. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Leslie Ovalle answered the phones today. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a safe and happy Memorial Day weekend.